If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
And live on the KQED phone app, now 11 o'clock.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the Supreme Court considers who can a president fire. Many constitutional scholars say federal agency workers are protected from removal. This attorney disagrees.
I think the removal protections have been unconstitutional from the beginning. I don't think there is such a thing as an independent agency.
Also, Virginia's climate law demands 100% renewable energy by 2050. But the state is also known as the data center capital of the world. Can those two ambitions coexist?
We'd like to have the added generation to support the data centers, but without all the health effects and environmental effects.
And disguise, female domination, architecture, the world of ants. Coming up here now.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Trump is set to introduce a $12 billion aid program for farmers suffering amid the administration's ongoing tariff policies. The new policy will give certain farmers one-time payments. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports.
Trump is announcing the new program at a roundtable featuring farmers, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, and Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins. The majority of the money will go to farmers who grow row crops like soybeans, corn, and cotton. Trump's tariffs hurt many farmers as foreign countries retaliated by cutting their purchases of U.S. crops and as the cost of inputs like fertilizer and machinery rose. In announcing the plan, the Trump White House is blaming farmers' economic woes on former President Joe Biden, who left office in January. In a statement, White House spokesperson Anna Kelly says the payments are meant to, quote, bridge the gap between Biden's failures and the president's successful policies taking effect. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, The White House.
New polling data from the Pew Research Center show that the religious composition of the United States has changed very little over the last 5 years and that there's no clear evidence of a religious revival among young adults. Here's NPR's Sarah Ventry.
According to Pew, this stability in religiousness is striking because it comes after decades of religious decline. Though older people tend to be more religious than younger ones, Americans have grown less religious as they've aged. Historically, women have been more religious than men, but this data shows the gender gap in religiousness is closing. But it's not because men are becoming more religious. It's because women are becoming less. The survey shows that 70% of adults in the United States identify with a religion, but only a third of adults attend religious services at least once or twice a month, and 28% of adults identify with no religion at all. Sarah Ventry, NPR News.
After meetings in London today, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky will travel to Brussels to see European Union and NATO leaders. Terry Schultz reports a dinner conversation is expected to include discussion of an EU plan to use frozen Russian assets to fund Ukraine's recovery and war effort.
President Zelensky will hold a previously unannounced meeting with the top leaders of both the European Union and NATO at the home of NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. EU Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen will be there. One of her main priorities at the moment is convincing the Belgian Prime Minister to allow the use of more than $100 billion worth of Russian money immobilized in a Belgium-based financial institution as collateral for a loan to Ukraine. The plan envisions paying back the funds to Moscow after it compensates Kyiv for the damage it's caused. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Thailand and Cambodia are locked in new battles over a long-standing territorial dispute, this despite a U.S. brokered ceasefire for which President Trump has taken credit. One of several Trump is listed in his quest for a Nobel Peace Prize. It's NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. The number of workers on strike at the West Contra Costa Unified School District today is less than late last week. That's because the district reached a tentative agreement with food service and clerical staff represented by the Teamsters over the weekend. But no deal has been reached with teachers who plan to be on strike again for higher pay and smaller classes today. District officials say they're reviewing a counterproposal from the United Teachers of Richmond, and talks could resume tomorrow. Medical experts at UC Berkeley say a lack of data on female bodies has left women athletes at a higher risk of injury. KQED's Aya Ali Ahmad reports a new initiative aims to address that problem.
For decades, sports medicine has relied primarily on data from men, applying it to women for everything from concussion protocols to ACL recovery. Dr. Sydney Chang was the first female head team physician at UC Berkeley.
Less than 10% of sports medicine and sports science research has involved exclusively women athletes. Without that baseline epidemiological data, we have no idea how our interventions are going to impact injury rates and performance.
The new initiative will collect voluntary biometric data from Cal athletes to create predictive models for female physiology. Researchers say these tools will also help protect female firefighters and soldiers. I'm Aya Ali Ahmad, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. More news on our app and at kqed.org.
Support comes from Oakland, San Francisco Bay Airport. Beauty, pride, love. Learn more at iFlyOAK.com. Support for NPR comes from Subaru. The Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. And the listeners of KQED. Sacramento Valley, foggy through the early afternoon, otherwise mostly cloudy, a high of 50 degrees is forecast. That's it, according to the Weather Service. Clouds and sun mixed Bay Area, highs in the lower 50s to the low to mid 60s inland. Cloud cover returning tonight, coast and bay and areas of fog, especially after midnight tonight.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young in Boston.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. It's Here and Now. The question of power and just how much the president should have is once again before the Supreme Court today.
Specifically, justices have been looking at whether the president can fire a member of the Federal Trade Commission without cause because, as she was told, she didn't fit in with his administration's priorities. If justices side with the president, it will overturn a 90-year-old landmark decision. Kim Whaley, professor at the University of Baltimore Law School, is following this for us. Professor Kim, welcome back.
Great to be here.
And just to remind people, during his first term, President Trump nominated Rebecca Slaughter to a Democratic seat on the FTC, Federal Trade Commission. But then in his second term, in March, he emailed her to say that your continued service on the FTC is inconsistent with my administration's priorities and said he was removing her. What did the Trump administration argue today for why he can?
It's really a reconfiguration of the separation of the three branches of government. You know, this precedent you mentioned is 90 years old. Presidents have signed into law many, many statutes creating agencies. Congress creates the agencies. The president signs them into law with some restraints. There's over 24 agencies that are specifically at risk here. But the Trump administration is arguing that the president's power over anyone within the executive branch who exercises so-called executive authority, we don't know what the definition of that is, everyone needs to be removable at will for any reason. And so that includes, and some of the more progressive justices were asking questions about this, that includes every single employee that is otherwise potentially covered by civil service protections. The idea is it's at the whim and the political discretion of the president because otherwise it's a threat to individual liberty to allow Congress to have the authority when it creates agencies to put restraints on the president's removal power, which, by the way, isn't even in the Constitution. No. But I think all the parties agreed that the president does have some constitutional removal power.
Okay, so we're going to be talking about the Congress in just a second, but some of the president's supporters have long believed in something called the unitary executive theory. That's the president having complete control over the executive branch. Does this fit into that desire?
Yeah, I mean, this dates back to President Bush during the War on Terror and the torture memos, listeners might recall. The argument back then was, as commander-in-chief, there just can't be any restraints, that there is no checks. There are no checks and balances on presidents during times of war. And the argument here is there's no checks and balances on presidents when you're talking about anyone within the executive branch being fired. And, you know, I think it's playing out in other aspects of this presidency through executive orders, attacks on other parts of the Constitution. The idea that the president really is special in the separation of powers. It's not a co-equal branch. It's the ultimate, the supreme branch. And I think John Sauer, the Solicitor General, effectively conceded that element, that the president should be special in our constitutional system, which is not historically how it's been perceived by the court.
Well, but what is Rebecca Slaughter's team, the rest of the team, arguing for why she should not be fired?
Their argument is, listen, you know, Congress has the power to create agencies and impose kind of restraints on how the agencies function, and that there's plenty of political accountability for that through Congress. And that's just how it's always been done. And that granting the relief that Trump wants here would mark a massive reshifting of the structure of government. It would upend many, many agencies, potentially people's jobs, and that there's really no problem that needs fixing, that this is just the way it's always been done. And there's no need to upend it now because it's never been abused, this idea of unlimited power in an individual branch of government without the president having some kind of oversight.
Well, let's listen to, for instance, here's Justice Neil Gorsuch seeming to blame Congress for, you know, kind of giving up its power. He's speaking with the Solicitor General John Sauer.
General, let me suggest to you that perhaps Congress has delegated some legislative power to these agencies. Let's just hypothesize that. And let's hypothesize, too, that this court has taken a hands-off approach to that problem.
So he's saying it's a problem, Congress's fault. And here's Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
You're asking us to destroy the structure of government and to take away from Congress its ability to protect its idea that the government is better structured with some agencies that are independent.
So, Kim, we only have a minute here, but, you know, you mentioned the Constitution. What is, you know, there's precedent. What does the Constitution say?
This is really important, Robin, and that is that when you think about executive power, that's a police officer, that's a prosecutor. But what Congress has been doing is creating agencies and giving them what looks like legislative power. They make regulations. They make rules. And they've been doing that for decades and decades, understanding that they could put restraints on the president's ability to make law effectively. Mm-hmm. So what Justice Sotomayor is saying is here, like, wait, now we've created this system where the president does have power to make law through regulation. And now you're saying Congress can't, once they give them that power, restrain it in any way. So you're seeing an intersection of various parts of the Constitution, but ultimately what it means is a massive aggrandizement and lodging of power in one man in a way the system never anticipated. So after the fact, they're saying you can't take the power back now, Congress, that you've given it to the president within the branch of the executive branch, even though it's legislative and sometimes adjudicative power. This is talking about administrative judges as well. They've created this massive administrative bureaucracy. Trump is saying, now that you've created it, it's all mine.
Well, we were obviously going to talk about this again. Kim Whaley, thank you so much.
Oh, great to be with you.
2025 is the first year of this century that we'll see child deaths increase. That is the sobering headline from a new report by the Gates Foundation and the University of Washington. There are a few reasons for higher mortality for children under five around the world, but the report focuses on cuts to international aid, which has eroded the healthcare systems that have saved millions of lives. Brooke Nichols is a professor of global health at Boston University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So you weren't involved with this study from the Gates Foundation, but I do want to get your reaction to it. More very young kids at risk of dying around the world for the first time in decades.
So this is horrific. This is despicable. This is preventable. These are choices that humans have made, that decision makers have made, that we are not making this a priority anymore. The fact that we've fought so hard for these wins, and these are actual children, actual people's kids that are going to die, I think should shock all of us.
Is there a way to quantify how many children could die? Do we know?
Yeah, so from this report and also work from others, I mean, it looks on the order of millions of lives over the coming years. And this is all to do with directly because of the cut to foreign assistance. But there are other reasons why, at the same time, we might expect child mortality to increase anyway because of climate change-fueled droughts and floods. And all of this coupled at the same time with cutting of aid, when now we need it more than ever, I think we'll actually, these numbers that we see in these reports are actually underestimates, very conservative of what we can expect.
So you say there's several reasons why, but the cut of international aid is particularly concerning. But that's not just from the United States, is it?
Yeah, so the U.S. makes up the lion's share of a lot of these aid programs in terms of any individual country. But for example, the United States is not the only the donor to the Global Fund. There are lots of other countries all across Europe and other high-income countries as well. And we see across the board a general reduction in each of those countries' contributions. So it's sort of the U.S. said, okay, we're going to not invest in this anymore. And then other countries followed suit instead of filling the gaps. And so that's sort of what you started to see this compounded effect.
If we go back and look at 1990, when the death rate for kids under five was around 88 for every 1,000 births, right now we're at 36, so a significant improvement. How hard was it for the international community to get that number down so far in the past 35 years?
I think it was an incredible effort from countries, organizations, donors. There's very few public health interventions where we've seen such a massive impact. So on the whole, this was a lot of effort from millions of people over the last 30 years.
Well, and to get more specific, what are the main causes of death for these young kids, and what was done to help fix it?
There's a number of vaccine-preventable diseases, things like pneumonia and diarrhea, and being able to provide support to make sure that if a child has very severe diarrhea or pneumonia, for example, that they're able to get the right services and that they don't die from those diseases. Then we also have things like child malaria and making sure that kids have access to treatment if they become infected with malaria or can be tested or can get bed nets, for example. And we all have all of our immunizations as well, which has also prevented quite, you know, millions of deaths over the last several decades. And then also severe acute malnutrition. So this is more along the lines of food aid. So when there is a drought or a conflict or flood and we provide actual food to children, this is really also what prevents a lot of mortality because kids are extremely vulnerable to severe acute malnutrition in these kind of states. So there's a lot of different factors combined right there, but all of this really makes up what we see.
We spoke briefly to a representative from the Gates Foundation responsible for this report. They're calling not just for more funding, but for more efficient healthcare systems. And I'm curious, as countries scramble to address this problem, do you see any viable solutions short of more money?
In the short term, if we don't get more money and we can't fill these financial gaps, then we will start to see immediate consequences and deaths from this gap of funding. And I think over the more medium term, there are definitely efficiencies that can and should be found, especially if the responses are more centered and coming through country governments instead of, you know, one organization providing support for one specific service, but rather the funding going through the government and the government providing that support for the people that need it in their country. I think that will ultimately help make sure that the response is more sustained in the long term and potentially more efficient as well, so you're not having all of these vertical systems that are all sort of standing next to each other, but actually more integrated.
Brooke Nichols is a professor of global health at Boston University, talking about a report from the Gates Foundation that shows more children under the age of five are projected to die next year for the first time in decades. Brooke, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is Here and Now.
And we're looking ahead to 1 o'clock this afternoon, all things considered.
Scientists have discovered millions of new species on Earth since the 1700s, and we are averaging 17,000 more every year. But how many more are there?
The range of estimates of how many species are out there are from the low millions to the low trillions.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The mission to better understand life on our own planet, on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
Don't miss this, the latest news and more. The early edition starts at 1, an update later this afternoon at 4:30.
In such a chaotic year, where did you find beauty? I'm Gabe Moline, editor for KQED's Arts and Culture Desk, and we've been looking back at uplifting moments from 2025. The kindness of strangers, a sweet rendezvous, the joys of community. We're calling it One Beautiful Thing, a series of essays about special, personal moments from the year. Find it online at kqed.org/arts.
Support for KQED comes from Berkeley, representing Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, a ghost story told by Jefferson Mays, a special one-week engagement through December 21st. More info at berkeleyrep.org. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers announcing the Season of New Traditions event, going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at kia.com.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from Storyworth. Each week, Storyworth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, Storyworth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at storyworth.com.
It's Here and Now. The Commonwealth of Virginia is in a bind because 5 years ago, the legislature passed a law that requires 100% renewable energy on the grid by 2050. But Virginia is also home to more data centers than anywhere else in the country, and those new buildings require a whole lot of power. William Shoeb has been thinking about this. He's professor of public policy at the University of Virginia. Bill, welcome.
Yeah, nice to chat with you.
Yeah, nice to talk with you. So 5 or 6 years ago, when lawmakers were working out the details of this law to decarbonize the grid, nobody was really worried about how much electricity AI and data centers would demand. What's changed?
Well, exactly that. All through the 2000s, electricity demand in the state hardly grew at all. And then it really took off.
Are you able to quantify just how much the electricity demand has increased in the 5 years since the Virginia Clean Economy
yes.
Act passed?
We're tracking it pretty closely. For the last couple of years, data center demand by itself has been growing 25 to 30% a year. And data center electricity use in the state is now bigger than all of our industrial demand and is closing in on residential demand. In the next year or so, data center electricity use in Virginia will pass all use of electricity in homes around the state.
Wow.
So it's growing pretty fast. It's not unprecedented. We had growth like this back in the 60s. Back in the 60s, electricity demand grew 7, 8, 10% a year, almost through the whole decade. But it hasn't been like that for a long time.
You may have noticed that Virginia has a new nickname. Some people are calling it the data center capital of the world. Is it really that much? I mean, what's driving all this interest in this new infrastructure?
It really is that much. Part of it has to do with the history of how the internet started. It was a very good place for data centers to connect up to the internet. And I don't think anybody really expects that to slow down anytime soon.
Well, with the cost of power going up, this is an issue that's evolving politically. The incoming governor, Abigail Spanberger, campaigned on energy affordability. Here she is in her victory speech in November.
We're going to produce more energy, and we are going to lower costs, and we're going to do it by producing more energy here in Virginia, and we're going to make sure that large utility users make sure that they pay their fair share.
Interestingly, now Democrats control the state government. What solutions do they have to not only maintain their climate goals, but also to meet this demand for power?
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, we have had periods when electricity generation grew pretty fast. So it's not that's not unprecedented by itself. Trying to do it without causing a lot of damage to the environment and a lot of health effects, you know, because of the generation, the emissions from the generation is the new challenge, because we'd like to have the added generation to support the data centers, but without all the health effects and environmental effects of those data centers. The modeling we've done indicates we can get there. It's possible to do, but we just have to give the right incentives for generating clean energy and expanding the supply without the emissions that used to go along with the expanded supply.
Do you think there's any way to do this to meet that demand without more natural gas, which of course is a fossil fuel?
Well, it depends on whether you're talking about the short run or the long run. Because generation sales of electricity have been going up so fast, it may be that we need to expand the use of natural gas in the short run, but Virginia generates almost 10% of its electricity from solar energy now, and that percentage is growing from year to year. We're adding quite a lot of generation. Next year, we have a big new wind farm that's going to be coming online, and we have a pretty strong offshore wind resource that we can tap, plus there are plans to add, you know, new types of nuclear generation to the mix. The answer to your question is that in the longer run, it does seem to be possible. We just have to have the right incentives in place.
So when you look at this broadly across the country, what do you think it means for efforts that have been in place to slow down climate change now that the cost of energy is becoming such a major political issue?
Well, in Virginia, non-emitting energy resources like solar, for example, that's our cheapest new source of energy. So if we were just picking new sources of energy along that cost continuum, we want to build plenty more of that solar. Now, we need a mix of different types of generation. We need the intermittent renewables. We need some baseload power. But the development of new technologies, especially new nuclear, and people are talking about developing geothermal with, you know, directional drilling technology that gives us the ability to tap geothermal power. In the short run, we have good technologies we can use. In the longer run, there are new sources coming along that can substitute for what we've been using. I mean, we have the development of a fusion energy power plant in central Virginia, a proposed one. So by the time we get out to the point where we have really binding constraints on our ability to meet new energy demand, we're going to have new options available. So I think it's really partly a matter of making sure that we're open to those new technologies as they become available and we're ready to incorporate them in our energy mix.
William Shobe is professor of public policy at the University of Virginia. Bill, thank you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Well, this week we're going to look at some of those alternative power sources Bill Shobe just mentioned, including geothermal and nuclear. Tomorrow, how Michigan and Pennsylvania are bringing old nuclear plants out of retirement.
Norman Rockwell's paintings are powerful symbols of American identity, so much so that the Department of Homeland Security has been using them in social media posts, and WBUR's Amelia Mason reports that's been causing a lot of upset.
When you hear the name Norman Rockwell, what pops into your mind?
Bald guys with big ears.
Well, it's like Americana. It's sort of, it's a lot of like 250s idealism.
It's like so perfect that it was like almost campy.
No.
Tiny white boys looking cheerful.
Yes.
Yeah. That was Erica Roderick, Gus Voorhees, Christine Bachman-Sanders, and Emily Moore, who gamely participated in a straw poll I took at a recent dinner party. The results were mixed. But there was a sense that Rockwell's work captured something essentially American. Here's how Rockwell's granddaughter, Daisy Rockwell, puts it.
His name is an adjective. Like, oh, this is such a Norman Rockwell situation. And I don't have a perfect Norman Rockwell family.
Rockwell's images have found new life on the internet. Recently, some of them appeared in social media posts by the Department of Homeland Security, the agency overseeing Trump's immigration crackdown. One featured a group of people gazing reverently at the American flag with the caption, "Protect our American way of life." It's a message Daisy Rockwell takes issue with.
I see that as a white supremacist message because everybody in the painting is white. And protecting our American way of life means getting rid of all the other people.
Many of Rockwell's family members agree. In an op-ed published in USA Today, the family wrote that Rockwell would have been devastated to see his paintings mustered in support of the Trump administration's anti-immigration agenda. The Rockwell they describe was politically progressive and outspoken about civil rights. And yet, an idea persists that his work represents an America we ought to return to. It's possible to find fodder for both interpretations at the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts.
We're looking at a young black girl who is being escorted by four U.S. Marshals to her first day at an all-white school in New Orleans.
On a recent visit, the museum's chief curator and deputy director, Stephanie Plunkett, shows me a painting inspired by the desegregation of the New Orleans schools. The little girl in the painting looks resolute as she walks past a racial slur scrawled on the wall behind her. It's a striking image and hard to misread. In the next gallery, we check out one of Rockwell's more flexible images.
Well, this was a long-time meme, actually.
Freedom of Speech depicts a guy in a ratty coat, looking dignified as he addresses a crowd of men in jackets and ties. This image lives today in meme form, giving voice to the internet's hot takes. It's possible to interpret the painting somewhat literally, a white working-class man daring to speak an unpopular truth to an audience of elites. But Plunkett offers a more metaphorical reading.
The common man can be a great orator and can express ideas in very articulate ways.
The painting is one of a series called The Four Freedoms, made in response to President Franklin D. Roosevelt's 1941 State of the Union address, in which he made the case for U.S. involvement in World War II to combat rising fascism. The Four Freedoms were later part of a touring exhibition to raise war bonds. Plunkett says the American public at the time desired these very concrete images.
To remind them of what they had and what should not be lost.
That's really interesting. I mean, yes, these were in some senses propaganda, I guess. Like, they were selling a war, right?
I don't think they were selling a war. I think they were selling ideals, and ideals that were central to who Americans believed they were.
Either way, the Four Freedoms still strike a chord. Plunkett says people are sometimes moved to tears in the gallery. Visitors tell her that the paintings remind them that our freedoms are not guaranteed and that we must fight to keep them. Interpret that as you will. For Here and Now, I'm Amelia Mason.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Live from NPR News in Boston, I'm Sharon Brody. The U.S. Supreme Court is weighing today's arguments over the Trump administration's push to expand control over independent federal agencies. Lawyers for the administration defended President Trump's decision to fire a Federal Trade Commission member without cause. Those attorneys called on the high court to jettison a unanimous 1935 ruling that limits a president's ability to dismiss board members of such agencies. The New Orleans Archdiocese will pay at least $230 million to hundreds of victims of clergy sexual abuse. A federal judge approved the settlement today after years of negotiations. A Brazilian woman with family ties to White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt will be released from immigrant detention while she fights potential deportation. An immigration judge ruled today that Bruna Ferreira can be released on a $1,500 bond. Ferreira previously was engaged to Leavitt's brother, and they have an 11-year-old son. ICE agents arrested Ferreira last month in Massachusetts. Ferreira came to the U.S. as a child and enrolled in the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Israeli police have forcibly entered the UN agency compound for Palestinian refugees in East Jerusalem. The raid escalates an Israeli campaign against the organization. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for KQED today comes from Stay Healdsburg, home to a holiday collection of festive events and immersive experiences. Learn more at aseasontosparkle.com. Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. After some morning fog, more sunshine continuing throughout the Bay Area the rest of today. The Weather Service says highs in the low 50s to the low to mid 60s. Dry weather will continue right through the week. The next chance for rain is forecast around December 15th. Sacramento Valley still continued foggy through the early afternoon, otherwise mostly cloudy. Highs only 49 to 56 in the Sacramento Valley, down to 41 tonight.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design.
MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. And Americans United for Separation of Church and State, defending church-state separation and the First Amendment, including freedom of the press, for nearly 80 years. Learn more at au.org.
It's here and now, and a look now at that decision by a vaccine panel at the CDC to overturn a decades-long recommendation that all newborns get vaccinated against hepatitis B. The new recommendation is only infants whose birth mom tested positive for hepatitis B should get the vaccine at birth. Other moms should talk to their doctors. If a vaccine is recommended, delay it for a couple of months. Why? Since the introduction of the universal dose recommendation at birth in 1991, infant cases of this deadly disease that leads to liver failure and death dropped by more than 95% nationwide. But members of the panel repeatedly pointed to Denmark.
Consider why, when we have a similar prevalence of hepatitis B in the United States as they do in Denmark, why Denmark has decided that they should not routinely recommend it to children.
Tracy Beth Hoag there, one of the vaccine skeptics on the panel. She was appointed to the FDA by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., asking if Denmark doesn't routinely give this vaccine at birth, then why should the U.S.? Well, let's get an answer. Professor Beata Kampmann is director of the Center for Global Health at the Charité University of Medicine, Berlin. Professor, your thoughts.
There are two points to this. The first thing is you have a similar rate of hepatitis B in newborns precisely because you had the recommendation to vaccinate babies at birth, because that has reduced the prevalence of hepatitis B in newborns by 95%. And the second thing is Denmark has universal health coverage. Wait. And the problem with the U.S. is that there are many people who fall through the cracks as they cannot afford or cannot access or are not aware.
So that's one huge difference. Here's Adam Langer, the acting deputy director of the CDC's National Center for HIV, is one of the few dissenting voices left on this vaccine panel, you know, explaining more about why Denmark is different.
More than 95% of pregnant women in Denmark are screened for hepatitis B. This is far higher than the number in the United States. Prenatal care is free for both citizens and refugee or asylum seekers in Denmark. We all know this is not the case in the United States.
And he went on and on with the differences. It sounds like you agree.
I mean, this is precisely the point I was making, because there is already a huge issue with equity in health in the United States. And women who do not access antenatal care and screening, and who might come from marginalized communities already, the Hep B prevalence might also be higher in these communities. So what will happen is people will either not get screened or the screening result will not be available. The vaccination at birth is a safety belt recommendation, to be perfectly honest, but it has been highly successful in the United States to reduce the cases. In 2020, you only had 10 cases.
What does delaying it a couple months do?
Most European countries actually only give the vaccine after 2 months, 3 months, and 4 months of age. The vaccine needs three shots, but not in the case of a baby being born to a hepatitis B antigen positive woman, because there the transmission happens exactly around the time of birth. So by the time the baby gets the 2 months dose, it is then already infected. Mm. If the baby doesn't have a risk of exposure, it's perfectly fine to vaccinate at 2, 3, and 4 months, but you should not leave a baby that is born to a Hep B positive mother unprotected. And that's why the birth dose in the United States is the safest way to deal with this problem.
Professor Beata Kampmann, director of the Center for Global Health at the Charité University of Medicine in Berlin. Thank you, Professor, so much. And we'll continue to follow this story here and now.
President Trump is pursuing aggressive policies in the Western Hemisphere that include anti-immigration crackdowns, military strikes on suspected drug smugglers, and threats of regime change in Venezuela. His administration is now reaching back two centuries and calling the approach the Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. That story on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Catch the story, the latest news, the California Report, all tomorrow morning, bright and early, starting at 2 a.m. Support for KQED comes from San Francisco Ballet, presenting the holiday tradition Nutcracker. Listeners can experience the captivating music, magical performances, and an onstage blizzard. Runs now to December 28th. Tickets at sfballet.org. PG&E, if customers see a down power line, stay away from it. Keep others away. Call 911. Let first responders come out and handle it. Police and fire will respond as well as PG&E. PGE.com/safety.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the Mehrotra Institute at Boston University, hosting the Is Business Broken podcast, featuring conversations with academics, industry leaders, and politicians. More at ibms.bu.edu. And CitySpace Productions, WBUR's creative studio for custom podcasts that tell a brand story to ignite engagement, reach new audiences, or enhance customer connections. WBUR.org/creative studio.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now. And now a moment to consider the ant, the tiny creature with the high hopes, as that song goes. Did you know there are 2.5 million ants for every one of us? It might feel that way when carpenter ants are eating through your deck, but they might meet their own fate. Did you know the spiny ant hijacks the carpenter ant colonies, first killing their queen, then covering their own spiny queen in the carpenter scent? She goes on to rule the unsuspecting carpenter colony who unwittingly bear her spiny babies. It's like an insect handmaid's tale. Daniel Sepka finds it fascinating. He's a curator of science at the Bruce Museum in Greenwich, Connecticut. They've just opened a new show, Ants, Tiny Creatures, Big Lives. Daniel joins us now. And you say ants run the world. How so?
They really do. They make our Earth function. So they're digging their tunnels into the ground and allowing water and air and nutrients to penetrate into the soil. They're recycling dead organic matter. They're a food source for thousands and thousands of other species. So they're really, really important creatures.
Yeah. Talk about their architecture.
I am just amazed by ant architecture. They somehow create these wonderful nests under the ground. When you have hundreds or even thousands or tens of thousands of ants in one colony, they can create really large and elaborate nests with all these branching structures. There's chambers for the queen, for the eggs. There's graveyards underground. There's chambers where they grow their food. They basically have agriculture going on down there.
But your exhibit is largely female ants. Remind us why.
Yes, there's only one male ant in the entire exhibit, and he's in a photograph. That's because in the ant world, the females, they basically do everything. So the queen is obviously female, but the workers, the soldiers, the ants that are in charge of storing food in their own bodies, the turtle ant, phragmatic soldiers that block the nest entrances with their own heads. These are all female. The males basically only exist to mate. They hatch, they mill about, and then on the nuptial flight, what they call the nuptial flight, the males are usually winged. They fly off. They hope to mate. If they do, if they don't, either way, they're probably dead within a couple of days.
They mate, they die.
So there's so many different species of ants. There's probably about 20,000 species out there right now. We haven't even named all of them yet. And within each ant species, there's often this amazing division of labor where different individuals take on different roles.
Well, let's talk about some of that. You have a replica of the ant from Mars at the show. What is that?
Yeah, this is an ant that is so unusual in appearance that they gave it the name basically the Martian ant. So in 1998, scientists discovered two workers recognized they belonged to a new species, but the specimens ended up, I think they fell out of the vial because the lid wasn't on quite right. And it took 5 years for them to find another worker. And so it's the only looking, it's very pale. It lives underground. I think it's blind as well.
What's a thief ant?
You talked about the spiny ant that invades the carpenter ant colonies. And so there's a lot of cases where ants will attack other colonies of their own species, of other species. There's cases where they'll actually steal the eggs or the pupa or the larva of another ant and raise them basically to be their servants.
It's like War of the Worlds, or as you wrote, Manchurian Candidate, when it comes to the spiny queen who goes in masquerading as the carpenter queen. And slowly over time, all the carpenter ants are bearing her spiny babies until it is a spiny colony. It's amazing.
It comes back to the way ants communicate. Smell doesn't mean that much to humans, but for ants, it's their main form of communication. So they use chemical communication. They use pheromones to mark a trail to food, to tell their nest mates where to go to get more food. They use it to say, it's me, let me in, to identify themselves to the soldiers, to let them back in the nest. They use it to say, back off, to other ants. And the reason that spiny ant is able to take over is she cloaks herself with that same pheromone as the carpenter queen. And so the workers don't realize anything's wrong. Because she smells right, she seems like their queen, and they accept her. And other species use this, too. There's beetles that actually trick ants into feeding them by making the right chemical signal.
I want to say, though, the show that's coming up at the Bruce Museum in Greenwich, people are going to be able to smell what ants smell like. You'll have the scent chocolatey, disgusting, and yet no ants were harmed in the making of that display.
Yes, no ants were harmed. So typically to smell these smells, you either have to anger the ant or squish the ant. We didn't want to, you know, crush up a bunch of ants every day to renew our display stations. We have what we call a smell column. It looks a little bit like the machinery that shuts off the tractor beam in the first Star Wars movie. So basically, you can smell a scent that's very similar to what an ant smells like to us. And I say to us because they probably perceive these smells in very different ways. So, for example, the African stink ant, it gives off a smell that smells kind of like rotten eggs, and it does have to call for help. Mm-hmm. When they're trapped in a collapsed tunnel, they basically stink for help, and that encourages our nest mates to come dig them out. And so that smells really bad to us. To an ant, it's probably like a siren or an alarm going off. The chocolate smell is great. These trap trawl ants, they have a scent gland in their mandible.
Ooh.
And they release this smell that to us, it smells really good, like chocolate. Scientists have done experiments where when they drop a little droplet of it by some fire ants, it will kind of ward them off. And so this is maybe more like, I don't know, the equivalent of pepper spray or something.
Well, and thank goodness for scientists who are looking down. And that reminds us, thank goodness, for the late, great evolutionary biologist E.O. Wilson. We know he meant a lot to you. He meant a lot to us. He was a frequent guest on our program based here in Boston. His book, The Ants, won a Pulitzer. And once, Daniel, we walked through Walden Woods, you know, Thoreau's Walden Woods, to talk ants and look for them. And we're pawing through the leaves and the dead wood, and we can't find any ants. And it was like, where are the ants? So we sit down on a fallen log to chat, and then voila. Let's listen.
The time has come to make the environment, especially conservation of the rest of life, nonpartisan.
So, off record here, I suspect you may be sitting on an anthill.
I think I am. Do you mind? But, and I have a skirt on. So do
okay,
you mind?
So, oh, yeah. Bless my soul. It's a colony of carpenter ants. They're not swarming out. But shall we take a seat over here?
How marvelous. I mean, he's literally kind of looking under me to see this colony. Talk about his impact on you, on people who love ants.
That's a wonderful experience you had there. He did a lot of pioneering work. I mean, he was tracking invasive ant species when he was just a kid, you know, PhD level research, basically. He also did a lot of interesting work on how ants use chemicals to communicate on their social structure. So he's really a foundational voice in entomology. I love that you're referencing carpenter ants. They are wonderful to look at. I think there's such an important study system. Wilson wrote, I mean, I'm sure hundreds of papers on ant biology and ecology and evolution. And there's something that people can grasp onto. My daughter Phoebe had her first ant farm this summer, and every day she took out a little journal and drew the tunnels and how they change and label them and everything. And you can really learn from them. They can get people into, you know what, I'm going to say into science, but maybe I should say also out of doors, you know, looking under those rocks, under those pieces of dead wood for carpenter ants, feeding the pavement ants a piece of sugar and seeing what they do with it, finding citronella ants coming out of the ground on their nuptial flight. That's one of the most special times I've ever had with my family. My wife, Kristen, called me outside and said, the citronella ants have come out. We haven't never seen them before. They've probably been in our yard for 10 years. They came out of the snag, and they're just gorgeous orange color like amber, and the males are flying. Their sisters are seeing them off. We're waiting for one of the queens to emerge. You can have a lot of fun if you just look down.
What a wonderful experience.
So, Robin, can I stand up for the carpenter ants?
Well, please do.
I think they get an unfair reputation. People associate them with, like, damage to their homes, and they can't really chew through wood that's in good condition. If you find them somewhere, it's often because there's already rot from fungus or termites are in there. They're kind of more of like a warning signal. They're kind of like a tire pressure light coming on.
I will now try to think of carpenter ants as racing out to warn me. I'll try. That's Daniel Sepka, curator of Ants, Tiny Creatures, Big Lives. It's a show currently at the Bruce Museum in Greenwich, Connecticut. If you can't get there, they've got great pictures on their website. And if you can't get there, go get an ant farm. and E.O. Wilson's book, Ants. I know you've got hands-on stuff there. This could be great for kids. What kinds of things?
There's a make-your-own ant interactive where you can select the head, middle, and abdomen. Do you want a stinger? Do you want to be able to shoot acid? Do you want wings? Do you want spines? there's a sting meter where you can press a button near a picture of an ant, and it will show you how strong the sting, how painful it is. And this is based on a scientist, Justin Smith. He created the pain index for insects by having them sting him intentionally.
Oh boy.
So it goes from a 1 to a 4, and you can try to guess which ant is going to be the worst for you. There's a lot of fun things you can do. Really good for families.
Wow. Daniel, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. It was a pleasure.
It's Here and Now.
And It's Here and Now coming up at noon.
An author adopted from Korea grew up yearning for information about her birth parents. As an adult, she learned that open adoptions are complicated. Next time, Here and Now.
Starts at 12, another hour of Here and Now coming right up. Support for KQED comes from East Bay SPCA, proud to connect Bay Area pets and people so they can share the love this holiday season and help save lives. For more information, visit eastbayspca.org. Postman, used by over 40 million developers and 98% of the Fortune 500. Postman offers a platform where teams build APIs that help AI agents and humans make smarter decisions. More at postman.com.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com. And Made In, makers of cookware found in restaurants around the world, offering a carbon steel nonstick griddle for home use, designed for use indoors or outdoors, on a grill or over an open flame. More at madeincookware.com.
It's Here and Now. The tech industry is pouring billions upon billions of dollars into artificial intelligence. But is it time for a reality check? Here's Google DeepMind CEO Demis Hassabis at an Axios AI event last week.
So I think it's not a binary. I think some parts of the AI industry are probably in a bubble. But on the other hand, of course, I, or more than anyone, believes AI is the most transformative technology ever.
Even some industry leaders are talking about an AI bubble. So what happens if it goes pop? Let's put that question to Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent for Axios. Ina, welcome back.
Good to be here, Peter.
You know, this isn't new. We've been hearing rumblings for a few weeks about an AI bubble popping. Stock valuations for some of these big companies are incredibly high. What is the evidence that there could be trouble ahead?
I think the biggest thing is the level of commitments these companies have made to spend hundreds of billions, even trillions of dollars over the next few years. That's a bet, not just that AI is going to be big, but it's going to be incredibly big over a very short time frame. And I think that's the real risk here. It's not whether AI is real or not. And I think for probably the last year, it's been more of a debate. Is AI real or is it a bubble? And I think in the story I write today, I'm like, it's both. It's very real and it's probably a bubble.
I think it also depends on who you ask. Some executives appear to be saying the industry isn't even close to a bubble, and others might say, well, maybe there's parts of the industry that have gotten too hot. And I know that Axios has been reporting on large language models. Remind us what those are and why they might be vulnerable.
So there's some people that feel like large language models, let me step back. Large language models are things like ChatGPT, Anthropic, the popular wave of AI, which is not the only flavor. And some people feel like this flavor has gotten too much hype. You know, there was a time when machine learning was all we talked about and LLMs didn't really exist. And I think there's some people that believe these, while they're very impressive sounding, their inherent flaws make them unlikely to be what gets us to what's called superintelligence or artificial general intelligence, that we need a different approach.
Oh, no, go ahead, please. Sorry.
So there's some people that feel like it's just the flavor of AI that's maybe a bubble. Again, I think to me, it's not that any of these things aren't real and transformative. It's just how much value do they deliver over what time? And then to your other point, that parts of the industry can be in a bubble. You know, I was reminded also at our AI summit last week that, you know, enduring leaders are built during a bubble. Amazon and Google emerged during the dot-com boom. The bust was not everything that was proposed during that time is going to take off.
Okay, that is such an interesting point, because last week I asked Joel Mokyr if he thought AI was heading for a bubble. He just won the Nobel Prize for his work that explains how breakthrough technology fuels economic growth. And here's what he said.
It may well be, it doesn't look like it, but in the end, the power of technology to improve our lives is so overwhelming that a few bubbles, even so they may hurt investors, that's not going to essentially stop this sort of relentless march toward material progress, which we are experiencing today.
And his point is, well, the railroad bubble popped in the late 1800s. We still use rail. The dot-com bubble burst in the 2000s. We still, of course, use the internet. So talk about that. Would a bubble popping do any lasting damage to AI's march forward?
Not when you look back maybe 10 years later. It's going to feel massive. It's going to feel like AI failed if there's a bubble pops and there's a slowing of investment and we realize we have too much capacity. It's going to feel massive in the moment. But when you look back, we're going to say, yeah, AI was that transformative. And you just need to look back at the internet. Even some of the craziest ideas that we mocked for years after the dot-com bubble burst. So things like pets.com, Cosmo, Webvan, the grocery delivery, all of those things are now real businesses. It just took longer. So what I encourage people to think is that a bubble has more to do with timing than whether the underlying idea is correct. Because as you point out, we still use railroads, we still use the internet, smartphones were a huge revolution. So all of these things can be real and a bubble at the same time.
And you say it may hurt. I'm thinking about collateral damage. Companies have spent hundreds of billions of dollars on data centers to support the AI boom. Like, what happens to all that infrastructure, which is an actual tangible thing, if the bubble bursts?
Yeah, I think there's some question. I mean, some people point to there was a lot of fiber laid during the dot-com boom so that we would have really fast internet connections. And it was too much, and so it laid dark for a while, and then we eventually used it. This could be a little different because you're talking about chips, and they don't have as long a life as fiber connections or these things do. They get outdated over a few years. So I do think there's some pain there. I think it's mostly investors that will feel this pain.
Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent for Axios. Always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station, and from Rhodes Scholar, celebrating 50 years of transformative learning adventures for adults in over 100 countries. Learn more at rhodesscholar.org/explore.
Clinics are popping up all over offering ketamine in a variety of settings for depression, for anxiety, for chronic pain. There isn't a real standardized approach to how to treat someone using ketamine. Experts kind of describe this moment as the Wild West.
I'm Leslie McClurg. I'm a health correspondent for KQED. You can find my story about ketamine tomorrow at kqed.org.
Just ahead of lunchtime, Julie Deppish here with Oakland Traffic.
Hey, Dave, they are dealing with a hit-and-run crash on the Nimitz Freeway heading southbound 880 just after Oak Street. You've got the left lane taken away, and the backup starts at Broadway. Clearing that three-vehicle wreck, Milpitas on South 880, Great Mall Parkway. Not blocking lanes now. They're on the shoulder, but a little slow from Calaveras. BART still in recovery mode. 10-minute delay between SFO and Antioch Richmond, and they have resumed red line service between Coleman and Millbrae. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Transit traffic support from Glime the Jeweler. Support for KQED comes from Second Harvest of Silicon Valley, providing nutritious food to 1 in 6 people in Santa Clara and San Mateo counties. Learn more at shfb.org.